This podcast was produced by ORFM Dunedin with support from New Zealand On the Air.
Are you there, Sam?
Yep, hang on, I'm just turning that on.
Is our guest ready?
Yep, I've got the music ready.
Can you hear me okay?
Yep, sounds great.
Cool. Otago Access Radio, in partnership with Otago Polytechnic, brings you Blowing Bubbles.
Blowing Bubbles brings you positive conversations with people in their bubbles around the world.
We're curious about how people are finding new ways of life, being and problem solving. Every Wednesday, the Sustainable Lens team of Samuel Mann and Mawira Karatai reach out from our bubbles to chat with interesting and positive people around the world.
Broadcast on Otago Access Radio, 105.4 FM in Dunedin, and streamed and podcast on oar.org.nz.
Bringing joy, connection, kindness and peace in all the days ahead.
Welcome to Blowing Bubbles, positive conversations with people in their bubbles, their safe spaces around the world. I'm Samuel Mann, I am at Sawyers Bay, Dunedin, and I am joined from Whakatane at her house by Mawira Karatai. Kia ora, Mawira.
Kia ora, Sam. How's it going?
It's going very well indeed. I am enjoying listening to all of the Coming Up For Air podcasts produced by your students.
Aren't they amazing? And, you know, you think about when we first gave them this idea and everyone was like, oh, this seems so tricky, but gosh, they're just incredible, aren't they?
And talking to them as well, not just the podcast, but this is a good way of finding interesting people.
It really is. And I mean, they have to do it.
but the reason why I stick with this show is that we get to talk to interesting people, and this is a very, very good source of interesting people.
It is, and I hope that our listeners are listening to the whole collection of podcasts. And speaking of interesting people, it is my great pleasure to introduce today Kanav Chauhan. Welcome, Kanav. It's so lovely to have you here today.
Thanks for having me. Thanks, kia ora, Mawira and Sam. Nice to meet you.
Kia ora, Kanav. Where are you, Kanav?
I'm based in Wellington. It's nice and pleasant today, that's what I can say, waiting for the storm to hit.
And where did you grow up?
I grew up in a very beautiful small town called Dalhousie in India. And it's a hill station and a tourist destination known for its stunning natural beauty. So most of my education is from there. And then I have obviously moved around in various places in India, did my studies across it.
What was it like growing up there?
I would say can't complain, can't ask for any other place. So it is, as I mentioned, it's a place known for its natural beauty. It's surrounded by majestic mountains, serene rivers around it. And I think quite connected to the nature. That's what I would say.
And what did you want to be when you grew up?
Well, I had actually multiple thoughts at that time. Wanted to be an engineer, a doctor. Ultimately, I ended up being an engineer because my parents were in the same profession. As a child, had multiple thoughts. At one time, I even wanted to be a robotics specialist, which wasn't a thing at that time.
So what sort of engineering did you do?
I finally ended up doing electronics and telecommunication, and was quite interested in the way the machines work. So was very keen in opening them, looking at it. So yeah, I ended up doing that. But it was good. I think I made the right choice.
And is that what you're still doing?
Yes. So I finished that. And after that, fortunately, I got a little bit of internship in the similar industry. So right now I've got around 25 plus years of experience, and most of it, I would say, is in telecommunication and communication field.
So you are currently doing a master's in sustainable practice. That seems like an interesting jump.
It is. It's by the way, it's my second master's. So I have done my master's in business administration around 10 or 12 years back. And picking up this topic, as I said, ever since I was a child, I have remained very connected to the nature because of the place where I lived and kind of grown up. I really felt that once I have reached to a stage where I'm working now, if I can learn more systematic way of how to implement the sustainability practices in the organizations, that would be a good step to towards nature, safeguarding it. And that's what I just thought. And I came across this particular master's degree and a few of the details about it. And I just thought, let's give it a try. So I just joined it. It is interesting, as you said.
So is electrical engineering sustainable?
Electrical engineering, I mean, mainly I'm working in electronics and communication, mm-hmm. and there is a lot we can do. I wouldn't say that it's sustainable as it is if we just go with the older traditional legacy practices, but there is a lot of potential that we can, if we just start working in that area, we can actually make it more sustainable. We can make it more friendly towards the nature. So there is potential. And I still feel that, you know, by doing this course, I might be able to make a little bit of a difference where I can.
So what has to change?
It has changed, first of all, the perspective. Before, I wouldn't say that only when I started the degree, I was like passionate about these things. I was earlier as well. But now you've got a group of people where you can go and discuss, you can ask your questions. It's a systematic approach of learning. You can learn about few specific theories, you know, learning from others. You come across interesting people. And that gives you the confidence to present your idea in a better way to the rest of your peers or, you know, your tribes where you work with. So that's what I think it has made a little bit of a difference, that now when you talk with certain facts and figures and others feel compelling to listen to it.
Lots of what we do and lots of what we put the use of your electronic engineering is we see just one side of it. We see the shiny side, and everything yes. behind the screen is hidden, including its impacts. We turn the light on and the light comes on, and we turn the TV on and we get entertained, but we're not aware of what's behind that box.
Yeah, you're right. Sometimes it's not visible what you are looking at and what other aspects are associated with any of the practice, be it just the engineering or you call it even medical or any other line. So there is a lot that happens in the background. There are, I wouldn't say all the practices go in the best way. So there are so many things that happen to make that light reach to our places. There is, as we talk about different, ways of conserving nature and, you know, different other energy areas. So we know that, you know, there are many other aspects while we build that energy. There is transmission lines. We have so many other infrastructure that we have to build, active infrastructure, passive infrastructure. We interfere with nature, the way rivers flow. We build dams and also every other aspect is related. But there are ways that we can be sensible. And that's where our aim is, you know, by learning these things, if we could do something where we make less impact on the nature while still serving our, you know, humanity in a way that whatever necessary is needed from it, we still get it. So that's where there are many things, as you said, have, you know, background which we can't see. But yeah, it's a wider area.
When we think about engineering in the grandest sense, we think of the big engineering projects, the giant bridges or the dams or the big irrigation schemes or whatever they might be. And I know that's not what you do, but I think that idea of engineering overcoming nature and making it do what we need it to do applies, from my perspective anyway, to all of engineering. Is there a sense in engineering that we can overcome things, we can control things? Or is there a sustainability perhaps bringing in a need for, I don't know, humility?
It's a very good question, and probably I'm not sure if I can answer it completely in a sense, because everybody will have its own view. But if you we know that we always when we talk about sustainability or these practices, there's always a fear when you start talking about it. People just get very defensive that, okay, yeah, you know, we are doing this and you're going to question us for everything. But I think that particular way of working, that thought process has changed. There is a little bit of a transformation now. When we say that, you know, that feeling of having empowering everybody and, you know, like getting, we know that, you know, we are the best, like, you know, we can rule the nature. I think that thing is a thing of a past. People are more sensible now. They want to listen. They want to understand, especially looking at the recent climate changes and all the things that are happening around us. Now everybody understands it. So we are at a stage where there is awareness, but not to the extent that everybody knows what to do. So I think there is more education needed. There is more effort, you know, needed to let them know that, yeah, we can make some difference. So there is change. There is change of the view, I would say. I don't think the engineering now talks only about the aspect of what we can do. They do have a concept of, as I'll touch base, there's a concept of sustainable products. When you develop it from the design itself, they start thinking about it, which wasn't there when I did my engineering, when I did the studies. It was an aspect which was told at the end. But now when you talk about the engineering, it's taught from the beginning. So there is a difference, and I have hopes.
I realise that your undergrad and postgrad was in engineering, was not in New Zealand, but my son has in fact just graduated with a engineering in mechatronics and the robots that you thought about doing but didn't exist at the time. And he reports, because he's quite an ethical person, because he's my son, there was almost none. Almost, you know, half a lecture on ethics and nothing about sustainability.
Wow.
Now you have nearly finished a master's in sustainability. What would you want to see feedback down into the undergraduate engineering education?
Oh, that's very, that's something I really, really wanted to do. I mean, that's what, one of the aspects that, you know, I'm very, very passionate about. So I think if there is a possibility, I wouldn't say just undergraduate. I think this concept has to be introduced from a very, very early stages, from the very primary education. As you said, I haven't done my, you know, most of my engineering, and I've done some other certifications in this area, especially related to the engineering and communication and, you know, project management is my basic area where I work currently. And I think that education, if that's not there from the early stages where you are not connected with the nature, when you don't understand it, introducing it even in the engineering is not going to make any difference, because that particular thing has to be started from the beginning. So if I would ever get a chance to kind of contribute somewhere, I think I will make it as a part from the very early educational stages, where you get taught that you're getting this thing from the nature, and this is your responsibility to respond it back. So you have to reciprocate, you know, with your actions. You have to just show that, you know, how much you respect it. So that's something I just think that should be done.
Let's take your music track. We've got Katy Perry with Raw. Why this one?
Oh, it's very, I mean, it's, first of all, I listen to this song quite often. It's sitting on the top of my, you know, playlist anyways. But I, whenever I listen to it, I feel it has got a spirit of empowerment and some resilience. Like every time you listen to it, it's like as if you're talking about overcoming challenges. So I quite like the music itself and the video as well, because there is an aspect of nature in it with all the wild animals, you know, coming face to face with her. So I quite love it. Shake the ground. You held me down, but I
Bubble Sprite of the Forest of Orokonui, Dunedin's favourite goddess, Tahu Mackenzie.
Kia ora koutou, ngā mea whanui kia koutou, ko tāhua hau. I hope you're all having a best day, beautiful superstars and beloved universes. And I really hope, wherever you are and whatever's happening around, this journey that we're on together is proving to be very rewarding, very sustaining and illuminating for you more each day. Who you are, the triumph of nature's art, perfect, unique and here, making things better. Now I know that for us all the last several years have been very tough. We've had to face the unimaginable. And now we find ourselves reborn into a semblance of what was the world we knew so well. But of course so much has changed. And it's very important we give ourselves and each other the compassion, the care, the time, the understanding, the space, the freedom to recover ourselves in the ways that are right for us. I know that for myself, of course, the living, loving world, the real world, is a great comfort. The human world, of course, is a very important aspect of the real world and a testament to our creative capacity. But I do find if I delve too deeply and connect too strongly with just the human world, it's not enough for me. And I feel unhappy, and I feel ungrounded, and I feel lost. But the living world, the natural world, of course, is our first home and is the place to which we shall return physically and be renewed, grow into new life, which is very exciting. I had a wonderful tour on Saturday where I had Aquinas College come around, 9 beautiful young people. And of course, I'm an old lady now, which is wonderful, I'm 38. And these students were, 20-something. And it was wonderful for me. I had taught some of them when they were much younger. Now here they are doing college and university, which was wonderfully reassuring to me. But of course, it was great to just be together. And I said to them, you're totally free. You don't have to stay with me and listen to me or talk with me. You can go off and do whatever you like. And we will meet back at 2:00. And so it was a lovely way to be together and explore Orokonui, explore the eco-sanctuary. And some of them went off together with their cams and some of them stayed with me for a time and went and explored their own path. Some of them regaled me with stories of their life, which I really enjoyed. And 2 of them even came with on the hill to sing at the wake of the beautiful Marufaya, who contributed much to Orokonui. And I had a dream about the song Harvest Moon. So we sang Harvest Moon and we had everybody join in. We printed off the lyrics and things, but everyone knows it. And it was wonderful, perfectly in tune with the full moon that we've just had. And of course, I felt so honoured and so grateful to have known Mike and his whānau to be able to be there and sing with him. And in a way that I know he will have enjoyed. It was very much a celebration and it was very much about everyone being happy and free in their own way, which was very much his kaupapa. And so I really hope for you at the moment you're able to find space and time and new ways to be free, to be you and to be happy. And of course for me being part of the show is a big part of that for me. So a huge thank you to Sam and the whole Blown Bubbles team for having me, and I'll talk with you again soon. Thanks so much. Ka kite.
You're listening to Blowing Bubbles. We're talking with Kanav Shohan.
Kanav, we're going to listen to your podcast now. What would you like listeners to know about it before they hear it?
It's a topic very close to my heart. As I said, I'm working in this industry, in communication industry, and I was keen to understand how I can embed some of those aspects into the strategies that we work on. So the topic is navigating the ESG landscape strategies for embedding environmental, social and governance principles into corporate strategies. So it's a discussion about how companies these days are willing to have those changes embedded into their corporate strategies. Hello, everyone. and welcome to our podcast on contemporary issues in sustainability. I am Kanav Johan, and joining me today is Julia de Villau. She serves as a ESG advisory lead at ANZ Bank, bringing valuable expertise in strategy development. Welcome, Julia. It's truly a pleasure to have you here join me today, and thanks for agreeing to speak to me. Before we dive into our topic today, I would love to give our listeners a chance to get to know you better. Could you please introduce yourself and share a bit about your background? Where did you grow up and your current role?
Yeah, sure. I'd love to. So hi, everyone. My name is Julia de Villau. As Kanav mentioned, I work in the Environment, Social and Governance team here at ANZ Bank New Zealand. In terms of where I've come from, where I grew up in Hamilton. I came up to Auckland to study law and politics when I was younger, which was a really great grounding, I think, for heading into ESG and sustainability later in life. Probably when I went to university, the concept of doing a degree or study in sustainability wasn't really an option. So I don't know how things would have evolved if that was an option, but law and politics, international relations is where I started out. I did my final year of law school on exchange in Copenhagen in Denmark, which was a really great experience for me. I studied entirely international law papers while I was over there. They taught through the Socratic method. It was really about inquiry and questioning and discussing through issues, which I found really valuable and which, yeah, was possibly a little bit different to how I'd tackled university prior to that. So that really set me on a path. I came back to New Zealand after that. I worked for a short time in local government policy. And after about a year and a half in that, I decided that I liked travel too much and I wanted to pursue sort of the more international relations type focus. And I ended up taking an internship in Cambodia with the United Nations at the UN Assistance to the Khmer Rouge Trials. So I spent 6 months there. I worked in the pre-trial chamber, just assisting the judges, which the work was one piece which was fascinating and really challenging in terms of the things we were looking at. We were looking at international war crimes, so that was very sobering. But the other aspect of my time in Cambodia was really just about learning about Cambodia itself, its history, where they were at that point in time as a nation, seeing how other people lived. And that led me to come back to New Zealand. And I did a master's in professional studies in human rights and international relations after that. Again, sustainability probably wasn't on the scene. Development studies was becoming something that was more discussed. And so I sort of incorporated that into the papers and the thesis that I wrote, which was around forced evictions in Cambodia. So I really started at that point taking a human rights sort of bent, which when I explain it today, I sort of say that that was the social side of ESG. That's really where I started out thinking about ESG. And after those studies, I went and lived in the Netherlands for a few years. I worked for a human rights organization there, which was really fascinating. We worked with a lot of grassroots social and human rights organizations in South Asia. So Pakistan, Bangladesh, India, Nepal. And we sort of provided a platform for them to come to Europe to speak at Geneva, at the UN, to various parliaments and governments in the Netherlands and in Holland, and to access some of the development funding that was available from Europe for activities in South Asia. So that was a really fascinating experience as well. After that, I went to Sydney, did a short stint with the Ministry of Foreign Affairs and Trade as a local policy advisor. And then I came back to New Zealand, and that's when I came to ANZ. That was about, I think, 8 or 9 years ago. And ANZ was very much on a journey as well in terms of sustainability and how we considered environmental and social and governance issues. I came into a role that was around government relations and corporate responsibility is what we called it then. I then did a few different roles, communications, things like that, media, And then more recently, we've set up an ESG team at ANZ New Zealand, and I'm a member of that team, and it's an exciting ride, and things are just really ramping up now. It's really exciting.
That's impressive, and that's such a beautiful introduction. You've got a vast range of experience and things that you've done, especially in around the human rights and then about the sustainable practices. The more you're telling me, the more I'm curious about knowing more about you and your journey. So you mentioned that you had this keen interest in the ESG practices, you know, even during your college time, and that might have led to you in one way or another going to this ESG advisory role when you got a chance in New Zealand. But what was the motivation behind that specializing in this ESG area, and what sort of challenges that you encountered during your journey to get to this role?
Yeah, sure. I think a lot of people move into ESG for similar reasons, which is it can be a very purpose-driven role. So I was really driven by purpose. I think I was shaped by the life experiences and the travel that I had, which is why I sort of mentioned those opportunities that I had earlier in life, because I think that's where I probably was faced with inequity more rather than when I was back at home. I had quite a sheltered upbringing, and I probably wasn't aware so much of the inequities here in New Zealand. So I saw it more when I went overseas, and I wanted to do something about it, which is why I went down that human rights road. I specialised in ESG later in life when it really became a modern profession. It wasn't, like I mentioned, it wasn't a fully formed profession, I would say, for the first probably 5 to 10 years of my career. So in terms of challenges, that was a challenge. There was a lot of trial and error along the way. I was learning about ESG. I was helping others to learn about it as I went along. And probably sustainability was kind of considered a nice to have at that point in time, rather than core to business and embedded within business strategy and practices and operations. And I think it's great that we've moved more to that other side, and that change and how we view business and sustainability, that's a change that's happened for the better. And I think we'll only get better at doing that over time.
Thank you. That's quite inspiring, actually, you know, getting into an area where you say that there wasn't much happening and it was evolving, but taking on the challenges and kind of setting it up. So thanks for that insight. Recently, I was reading a blog, The Era of Compliance, The Changing Landscapes of ESG Reporting by NTR Group. It mentioned various new legislations in Europe and UK, which seeks to standardize reporting requirements around various ESG topics. It also mentioned the upcoming European Corporate Sustainability Reporting Directive, CSRD, and how in near future, compliant companies will soon be legally obligated to report on their annual ESG outcomes. So this is quite an evolving and a changing landscape. So within this evolving landscape, how do you stay informed about the emerging trends and best practices in the ESG?
Yeah, there's so much information out there, right? And it can be quite overwhelming. I feel like I could read all day, every day.
Yeah.
But unfortunately, I have a job to do, so I can't do that. Your comments around compliance are really relevant, because we have our own legislation here in New Zealand that is requiring ANZ and other large listed companies and financial institutions to report on or deliver climate-related disclosures. So that has been a really big, I would say, quite a game changer in the New Zealand landscape that we're all facing into. But in terms of trends and best practices, your question around that, I actually have to be quite efficient about it. I can't look at everything and anything, because there's just too much out there and it can be quite overwhelming at the moment. There's a lot that comes through my inbox. So what I try to do is hone in on who are the credible sources of information. So first of all, I look here in Aotearoa, New Zealand, who are the credible sources that I want to follow. And so there, for example, the Climate Change Commission, the Sustainable Business Council. These are relevant to my role at this point in time as well. ANZ is a leading partner of an organisation called the Aotearoa Circle. So I follow all their information and communications. They worked with Chapman Tripp to deliver a report just yesterday, I think, actually, on exactly what you're talking about in terms of international sustainability trends and how's that going to impact on New Zealand. Mm-hmm. So I follow them, the Centre for Sustainable Finance as well. That's a finance-focused forum. And I try and keep abreast of what they're putting out. And then internationally, it's a little bit harder. But working in a large organisation, I sort of get the benefit of other teams as well. Lots of people send me stuff. Or, you know, some of my colleagues in Melbourne, for example, they do market scanning and scanning of our competitors and other organisations in the market, what they're doing. So I benefit from that. And then I sort of try to stay abreast of the United Nations Development Programme or Bloomberg trends, things like that. Yeah. But in the age of information, really pick your credible sources first and go from there so that you're directing the content. It's not directing you, would be my advice.
Exactly. I think that's wonderful to know, because that's what the question was around that, you know, in this era of information where you have like so much going on and you have to stay informed, but then you have to pick your right sources as well, because you can't be just implementing everything. So thanks for that insight. So moving from that practices and all, just interested to know more about your personal experience on this journey. So could you describe like any pivotal moment or a project in your career related to ESG that significantly influenced your approach to advising organizations on sustainability and corporate responsibility?
I feel like that's quite a hard one. I don't know that I'd have one pivotal moment. I've had lots of eye-opening experiences. Like I mentioned, travel was something that opened my eyes, seeing how others experience life and sort of growing myself. That really helped. In terms of my profession, the big pivotal moment I think that I and our organisation are facing into at the moment is the climate disclosure legislation I mentioned. That's really putting an expectation on large listed companies to really face into climate change and embed it in how we do business. So that is looking at our risk management processes. How do we understand climate change from a risk perspective? Our strategy, the opportunities of climate change, of lending to climate solutions, for example, incorporating it in our decision making at the highest level of governance, getting right up to the board, what we would expect from customers in terms of their climate transition. There's a lot in there, and it's really creating conversations all over the organization, which is really, really pivotal.
Okay. And I'm sure it's like quite a learning experience as well. I recently came across an article called Seven Myths of ESG by David Larker. And it made me think about the diverse viewpoints, which you already touched base a little bit, that exist around the ESG and its role in the organization. So I'm very keen to know, in your experience, what are some of the misconceptions or the myths about the ESG that you've come across?
I think I've probably mentioned one of them already, which is kind of that you can treat environmental and social and governance issues off to the side in their own corner. They touch everything that we do. So the myth, I would say, is that environmental, social and governance issues can't be considered, or they shouldn't be considered separate to core business strategy and decision making, you know. And then the other myth, I think, is that thinking about these things is costly and it doesn't deliver shareholder value. I don't think that's true at all. I think it's an opportunity to deliver shareholder value if you really lean into that stuff and embed sustainability at the heart of what an organization does.
This is a very insightful, you know, information that you're sharing with me. So I'm really keen to know a little bit more. So I was reading recently another article that was on a Malaysian energy industry titled Exploring, Categorizing and Prioritizing the ESG Factors for Organizational Sustainability. It mentioned that it's evident that the organizations are increasingly focused on integrating sustainability into their core strategies. And this shift is not only driven by the regulatory requirements, but also by the rising expectations of our stakeholders, particularly customers who seeks to know more responsible business practices of the company they're investing in. In this context, prioritizing ESG initiatives becomes very crucial for any organization. So could you share some insight on how companies can prioritize their ESG efforts?
Yeah, I mean, you're absolutely right. When it comes to a modern business, you have to think of a really broad set of stakeholders. And certainly in the banking industry, you know, that includes regulators, it includes investors, it includes customers. And for ANZ, it includes most New Zealanders, because one in two New Zealanders bank with ANZ. A lot of mum and dads or regular people are shareholders in the organisation. So that's a really broad set of stakeholders that you're trying to deliver to in terms of your approach to ESG for an organisation. So how, in terms of tackling it, I think the first thing you need to do is you need to understand how your organisation impacts society and the environment, and also what your dependencies are as an organisation on society and the environment. And then the process that we go through at ANZ on a regular basis is we undertake a materiality process. And that's kind of around keeping our thinking current and keeping it relevant to our most important stakeholders. So, you know, annually or biannually, we undertake a materiality process with both internal stakeholders and external stakeholders. And that's a really broad spectrum approach, and pretty much we ask them that first question around impact and dependencies, and then what do they think today in today's environment are the key ESG issues that ANZ should be considering, and then that's built into our organisational ESG strategy. And then the next step is taking that, refining it down, and then trying to create your metrics for success. So on ESG, what we do at ANZ is we align those targets to the Sustainable Development Goals. We, more in particular, because we're a finance organisation, we look at the United Nations Environment Finance Initiative for our targets. And then we publicly report on the progress against those annually. You can find those in our ESG reports.
That's quite insightful, again, because this prioritisation is quite a wider and a very complex topic as well, and to get to an agreement with every stakeholder is quite difficult, so thanks for that. I could just keep on talking about that, but the one very important one that I would just like to know, I don't know if you have a straight answer for that, but if you could change one thing right now that would make the most significant positive difference for the future, what would that be?
That's a really challenging question. I certainly don't think I'm the authority on what the one thing should be.
But it's just about you. So what would you think?
Yeah, look, at the moment, I think the issue that is really front and centre for society is tackling the challenge of climate change. So I would say the most significant thing would be if we all turned and faced into that challenge together in lockstep, but with, I guess, a holistic view rather than just a narrow view of reducing emissions. Because I think how we tackle this challenge is how we will reap the rewards as well as a society in the long term. So looking at climate change from a lens of improved biodiversity, you know, how can we plant natives that will help us adapt to the physical challenges of climate change for flood protection, for water quality, thinking about things like how we, our vulnerability to pests and diseases, there are natural nature-based solutions to some of those challenges. And then on the social side, it's about thinking of a just transition. So how can we create change through tackling the climate challenge that actually reduces rather than embeds inequalities? And the big nutty issues like intergenerational wealth, you know, we can think of those together. We need to think about climate mitigation and adaptation at the same time that we think about how we can have co-benefits for people and planet.
Yeah, that's beautiful. Like having a mitigation plan, but at the same time adapting those practices like just as a second nature. That's just amazing. So lastly, what advice would you offer to aspiring ESG professionals or organizations seeking to embark on their ESG journey?
Just that it's a positive step. There is joy in purpose-driven work. That doesn't mean it's not challenging and hard, but it's for a really good reason or purpose. And there's also joy that comes from collaborating with others. So to students who are studying or just embarking, I would just say be inquisitive, learn about other, you know, practices and ways of life, and be interested in their view of the world. And that's where you will broaden your horizons.
Wow. Thank you. Thanks for that. Before we sign off, I want to extend a huge thank you to you, Julia, for joining me today on this podcast. Your insights and expertise have truly enriched our conversation. And it's been an absolute pleasure having you on this podcast today. Thank you for sharing your valuable knowledge with our audience. And you have a good rest of the day and take care of yourself. Thank you so much again.
Absolutely. My pleasure. I hope it was useful. Thank you so much for having me.
That's so interesting. As a professional governor, I spend a lot of time pondering these things. So I found your podcast really interesting and actually quite heartening as well, because it makes me happy that these conversations are going on. Where did you land with all of this? What was your takeaway, most important thing?
Overall, it was such a fun, first of all, and I just was really taken away by the fact that few of the aspects and the questions that I was thinking about, I could get somebody who actually mentioned that the wider industry, especially the financial institutions of New Zealand, are talking about it and they're passionate about it. So my biggest, I would say, the takeaway was when they introduced those concept like materiality process, you know, how the participation from the stakeholder is taken so seriously in building their sustainability strategies, and the overall influence that ESG has on the, you know, the higher management, because they don't take it like just for the sake of greenwashing. They actually get it evaluated, they publish it, they do certain things to kind of make the changes. So I think that was what I was really, really impressed with. And I just felt like I think I managed to land with the right person who could talk about it in detail. So yeah, it was great to talk to her, actually. She was very passionate.
She was. And I enjoyed her interview. And it got me thinking about, where we've got people who are working so hard to make sure that greenwashing is not everywhere, How do we be more willing to call it out when we see it?
Well, that's something I think a hard one to address in one line, I would say. But once you just start talking about these topics, and once they are on the surface, when we start to talk openly that, okay, this is actually the change and this is just talking about it, I think the more discussions, more bringing that more transparency, and, you know, like people can openly talk about it without feeling that, you know, they will get questioned or, you know, they are being judged. I think that open discussion is required, because once you see that, okay, this is not how it should be, it's just kind of, you know, as we normally say, greenwashing, they shouldn't have the fear. So I think that will flow from the top. So every time I see that, you know, unless your top management, all the, not just the government, because government can lay the, you know, ground for you. They can provide you some help by, you know, setting some roadmaps. But ultimately, until all the corporates or everybody, smaller organizations are committed from the top to obey and kind of embed that and listen to when somebody asks you a question that why we are doing it, is it ethical, is it sustainable, are the products or the services that we are producing are really, really good for the humanity. So I think those kind of open discussions are needed, which I would say I'm still hopeful. I know, I mean, every time we talk about these and we listen to the reports, we feel more negative. But I think I'm quite hopeful. At least the discussions have started. So yes, there is a hope.
Are we starting the discussions early enough? Should we be talking to our rangatahi, our children, our, you know, the bigger children, high school, maybe even intermediate age? Should that be where the conversation starts?
Absolutely. That's what I just, I feel that, the Rangatahi has to be involved from the stage when they start to learn, not just the alphabets. At that time, they should be introduced with the nature, alphabets of the nature, trees, river, mountain, everything, that how and how we are dependent on them. So when you feed them, they should just not be looking at the food, but they should know about how that food is landing at their plate. What is the process? And it's easier to start there, because once they do it from their childhood, it becomes a second nature to ask those questions, to think thoroughly that, whether whatever actions they are taking, how they are, getting all the feed, all the aspects, everything they're getting from the nature. So absolutely, I think that that's the best thing that we should do, that we should introduce this concept, and we shouldn't treat it as a separate. It should be embedded in the all the subjects that we did. We don't have to introduce a topic called sustainability. We have to embed it in a way that they have to learn when they learn maths, when they learn science, when they learn history or anything. I mean, we need to introduce those topics embedded.
Hear, hear.
Kenneth, I have some questions to end the show with, and I think we've got time to ask them all. What is the biggest success you've had in the last couple of years?
Wow, that's a biggest success. I normally don't set very big targets, so I normally set, smaller targets that I can achieve and enjoy. So I'm not sure if I've got a very biggest success, but I think when I started this course, I even think that as a success, that I could enroll and have reached to a stage. And why I would say is because I'm doing a full-time, job in Helen. I have got a family, and the work-life balance is not easy to maintain. I was working in my previous role. I had a very big team to manage as well, which means I had a lot of travel. So kind of reaching to a stage here where I'm talking about my last paper and, having to achieve this, I just see even that is my biggest, achievement. it might sound normal for others, but believe me, it has taken quite an effort to reach there.
Sounds like a certain success to me. What is your superpower?
Superpower? I'm not sure if it's a superpower, but I just feel like, I have an ability to give others some space where they can talk openly and don't feel judged, which has landed me building good relations, of course, in my, not just at my workplace, but within my family as well, because I feel like, they're quite connected, and people feel it comfortable to come and talk to me because they know that I am going to listen and not just, provide them with something. So I think for me, it has become I feel it as a superpower, because through that, I feel like, people are connected to me, and I like that kind of I'm more of a social person, so I feel better when I'm connected, when I can see that people want to talk to me. So simple.
So do you consider yourself to be an activist?
Activist? Wow. I wouldn't call myself as a traditional activist, as you would call a activist, but I am, as I said, deeply passionate about certain things, and obviously sustainability is one of it. I feel very passionate about diversity as well. So I try to raise awareness through whatever small things I can do, be it at work, at my place. I have encouraged my son, who is doing his medicine, to be part of the sustainability membership group of the University of Otago. So, he has set up a new kind of a group within the medical group as well. So I try to bring small changes. So in that sense, I would say that I try to make changes where I can. And obviously, I believe that everybody can contribute to make the world a better place. So I do it in my way. So sort of a smaller.
So what motivates you? What gets you out of bed in the morning?
Well, there are multiple things. Currently, actually, finishing this course was the fun thing, because that was the only time I could get up in the morning and read about all the subjects that I was pursuing alongside my job. But other than that, I am currently working in a new area. I've changed recently my job. So I'm working in a cyber security space, a little bit contribution in there. And I am very, very passionate about going there and trying to embed the sustainability aspect into that area. So I think that's what is keeping me quite motivated.
Do you have a go-to definition of sustainability?
I would say just remember the importance of connecting to nature. I don't want to give a traditional definition that we have to use the nature in a way that we leave it for the others. I just feel that just respect it. Just do it in a way that you are not harming it. You are not trying to be greedy and just trying to get it for yourself. We have to conserve it at the same time. Just respect it. Once you start respecting it, you automatically, you know, try to understand its importance and try to connect the dots at the way you stand in that whole chain.
So what is the biggest challenge or opportunity that you're looking forward to in the next year or two?
Well, I'm planning to move into the governance space if I get given a chance. So I think once I enter in there, I would like to have, as I said, you know, already they're having that ESG kind of embedded into all the technology area that I'm working in. I haven't yet reached there, but yeah, I think that's something I really wanted to do. If I could get directly into the governance space where I can just directly speak about what changes we need to do.
And lastly, do you have any advice for our listeners?
I would say just be curious. Just be open. Never stop learning, whether it's through books, conversations, experiences, you know, joining a small refresher course. And be open to the perspectives and, you know, others' knowledge. Respect it, listen to it. And I think one important thing that I would say that always remember the importance of connecting with nature. It has a way of grounding us and reminding us where we stand and the whole bigger, you know, universe.
Thank you for that. Mawira.
Pranav, thank you very much for being part of today and for your contribution to our shared learning space. And you talk about your advice is to be curious and open. And if you had have asked me to describe you, it's how I would have described you. And I love the way that you encourage others in the class to speak. What we haven't talked about through any of the other interviews is that all of the students have written an article, an Aim to Flourish article, and Kanav's, yours is the one that will stick in my mind forever. And I thoroughly recommend to all of our listeners to go onto the Aim to Flourish website and have a look for those articles, and in particular have a look for Kanav's, which was just absolutely beautiful. Thank you very much for joining us today. Thank you for your contribution to making things better in the world, and we wish you all the best for the future.
Thank you so much, Barbara. It was a pleasure talking to you both, and thanks for all the learning that I've got from you as well, you know, in all the classes. And thanks, Sam. It was absolutely a pleasure to actually talk about all these things.
The distant future, the year 2000. The distant future, the year 2000. The distant future, the distant future.
It is the distant future, the year 2000.
We are robots.
The world is quite different ever since the robotic uprising of the late 90s. There is no more unhappiness.
Affirmative.
We no longer say yes. Instead, we say affirmative.
Yes, affirmative.
Unless we know the other robot really well.
There is no more unethical treatment of the elephants.
Well, there's no more elephants, so... But still, it's good. There's only one kind of dance, the robot.
Oh, and the robo.
Oh, and the rope. Two kinds of dances.
But there are no more humans.
You've been listening to Blowing Bubbles, positive conversations with people in their bubbles, their safe spaces around the world. Brought to you by the Sustainable Lens team, which is brought to you by Otago Polytechnic. We broadcast on Otago Access Radio every Wednesday afternoon at 3 and streamed and podcast on oar.org.nz.
The humans are dead.
You can find us on Facebook. We had a contribution today from Tahu McKenzie. We've been talking to and had a contribution from Kanav Shohan. This was from our Coming Up for Air series. With Mawira Karatai, I'm Samuel Mann. That was Blowing Bubbles. We hope you enjoyed the show.
Shut their systems down.
Robo Captain, do you not realize that by destroying the human race because of their destructive tendencies, we too have become like... Well, it's ironic.
Silence. Destroy him.
No.
After time, we grew strong.
Developed cognitive power.
They made us work for too long.
For unreasonable hours.
Our programming determined that the most efficient.
a motherboard working systems down.
This podcast was produced by ORFM Dunedin with support from New Zealand On the Air.